Okay. This is Liza Rozier, and this is an oral history for Washington County Museum. Today's date is May 7th, 2013. So let's go ahead and start with your full name, including your maiden name.
Sarah, with an H, Alice McMillan, M-C-M-I-L-L-A-N. There's a number of ways people spell that.
I saw on some of the census records they had an I-A-N on a couple of this, so it just depends on how they spell it. And what's your date of birth and place of birth?
April 12th, 1931, Colville, Stevens County, Washington.
Okay, and what's your family heritage? Maybe on both sides.
Scots, Irish, English.
Okay. And let's start with your grandparents. What names, maybe, and occupations?
Pardon?
Names of your grandparents.
Okay.
If you remember.
Dad's was Colin Riley McMillan, and my grandmother was, she was christened Sarah, but called Sally Dix McMillan.
And then
mother, Arthur Eugene Buchanan, and Alice Deborah Cox.
And kind of the same question I asked Rod, what sort of maybe upbringing did your family, like religion, morals, politics?
Okay, religion was Congregational Church, and there was also Presbyterian churches in Grandpa's background. And then the church in Colville, when I was growing up, was a federated church, because this was during the Depression, and the Congregational Church and the Methodist Church didn't have, you know, enough people, you know, to run both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kept their buildings, but we changed ministers. There'd be a Methodist minister, and we'd meet in the Methodist Church, and then there'd be a Congregational minister, and we'd meet in the Congregational Church.
Hmm. Just dependent on.
And so, and then sometime after the Depression was over, then they went back to the separate.
Interesting.
Denominations.
That they would combine during that period of time. That's weird. So the 1940 census for Stephen County shows that both your grandfather and your father were working on the same farm.
Yes.
What was that farm like growing up in Stephen County?
Well, it was. This was Grandpa's farm,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't think about when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And it was in the valley. You raised, they alternated wheat and alfalfa and raised cattle. And
so they did both?
They did both. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, because the way my dad looked at it, you didn't want to depend on just one thing. And so,
especially during the Depression.
During the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and plus the fact you needed to change crops too, because you needed the alfalfa to, you know, put nutrients into the ground, and both crops did better if you alternated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd raise wheat on for a while, and then you'd raise alfalfa.
So it doesn't kill the soil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then it also had to do, I mean, this is drier country than the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And so then on the raising wheat, well, they also raised oats. And you needed to, for the land to lie fallow for a year to absorb moisture.
Okay.
So you were also alternating plowed ground with wheat growing or oats growing ground.
So it was kind of like year it was somewhere different.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So you were constantly
alternating plots, alternating crops.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. Considering, with all the farming during them, they would have really been perfecting those techniques during that period of time. What do you remember about grammar school in Orrin, Washington?
Mm-hmm. In Orrin?
Oh, any stories, like
the
games, events that you went to?
Well, first of all, the first the first day of school, maybe even before that, is that there was a huge sawmill, right? I mean, the Colville River ran through the middle of the valley, and there's a huge sawmill out in front of the house, and it burned in August. And so then...
August of what year? Do you remember?
I suppose we're talking 1937.
Okay.
And I'm always getting off. My birthday is in April, and so... I mean, there's, it's easy to get the years confused, but it burned in August. But anyway, my first day of school, Grandpa took me to school on the horse. I mean, put a gunny sack, you know, behind the saddle. And
he sat on the gunny sack.
And then he took me to school. And I gather, according to my sister, he did this 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. It was probably... quarter of a mile, half a mile, you know, to walk. But after that, I walked.
Big enough.
I walked when I was in the first grade, you know, after I got used to it.
And the rural setting, I would assume, that you lived in...
Pardon?
The rural setting that you lived in probably constituted a lot of walking, right?
Horseback riding.
A lot of horseback riding.
Mm-hmm. Both.
So that's interesting that Rod didn't do much horseback riding.
He didn't do any.
But you did.
Oh,
so that's cool.
Oh, a lot. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What an interesting difference, considering you were in the same regions of areas, you know. Who taught you to ride? Your dad?
Actually, what they did, you know, like when I was just little... He'd put me in front of the saddle, and then we'd ride up the hill to the field and back down. And this was just a really big deal. Mm-hmm. Big deal was to have your picture taken on the saddle, you know, with you know, my dad, you know, holding me. And then my sister came along, and all of a sudden I'm down at the barn, and my sister is getting the ride. So I sit outside the barn door and howl.
Oh, because you were so mad.
And she got the ride.
Oh.
So we learned to take turns.
Mm-hmm. Sibling, good old sibling rivalry, right? So we can talk a little bit more about the Depression if you have any maybe stories about that. How did that affect your family's economic status, if at all?
Well, it... That is kind of hard to judge, but like going to school, like your Oxfords would you know, go through the soles. Well, you'd wait till Saturday to go to town when you did your grocery shopping and get your shoes half soled, and I didn't think about it. You don't think about it at the time when you're growing up. You don't have that many changes of clothes. And
did your family have the attitude? I know there's sort of a Depression attitude of saving everything. Did they?
Oh, well, they were like always. That? I mean, they're Scots. They're savers. You save up for.
Sure.
That's
interesting. What were their attitudes towards, especially with you being a woman, what were your parents' attitudes towards education versus work? Like, would they have, you know. Or would they have rather you stay home and be a housewife, kind of thing?
Oh, no, you got an education. Grandpa said, Grandpa had five children. He sent every one of them to college.
Wow.
And
so that was a very important aspect of...
Now, he maybe had a grade school education, and he didn't go on. And he was a younger son living in Ohio. And there were older brothers, didn't see any future for him on the farm, so he was probably 17 or 18. He left home and worked his way west. Wow. And, you know, in Illinois, worked on a farm, met his future wife, went to Colorado, learned to be a flour miller, came on to Portland, and then ended up in the Colville Valley, which he thought was the prettiest place he'd ever seen.
Paradise.
And so, as I say, basically you saved up for. I mean, we had a car, and you Spokane was about 80 miles away, and so you'd make your list for things you couldn't get in Colville. Mm-hmm. And then in some respects, I think the area was, I mean, this is a country situation. This sure. is not a city situation. Yeah. So you can raise your food and, you know, you had livestock, you had pigs, chickens.
So fairly self-sustaining.
So there was certainly self-sustaining about that, and then you had a crop you could sell.
Interesting. Did you help on the farm with the work on the farm also, or were you just always in school? I love the look on your face.
Actually, Orin's school was interesting because, I mean, this is one teacher with six grades. And so, you don't have to do a lot of things. Like at recess, you went out and you played together. You changed your games. You swung on the swings or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you're sort of independent. And then, growing up, at the very beginning, we followed Grandpa around. And we'd feed the chickens, mm-hmm. and I'd turn the wheel on the for sharpened knives on the wheel. And, yes, I'd turn that while Grandpa sharpened knives, and we'd hold harness, you know. So when he was mending harness, you know, we could hold it still, and he could put a rivet in, you know. Sure. So I think that we grew up with the idea that there are things that we always had chores. Mm-hmm. And
there could always be improvements.
Well, and it was like, Grandpa taught me how to saddle a horse. And so eventually by the time I'm in the sixth grade, I can go get the milk cows. And then we bring in the wood. Mm-hmm. That was one. Well, then we all were also supposed to weed in the garden. And Mother watched me weed one day. We'd get a nickel a row. And Mother watched me out the window. She's sewing. And then when I get done, you better go back and do that right.
She watched
this was not really my thing. And so then, like in grade school, we were old enough that we had thrashers for wheat river sower, you had hay hands, and we had a cherry tree. And, you know, they had little pie cherries. Mm-hmm. And so we'd have, you know, a little bucket about like this, and you'd get 10 cents
for a bucket of cherries?
For a bucket of cherries. Then you had to pit the cherries. But in the summertime, we'd have a girl, you know, a girl that helped out Mother with the cooking. And
So you guys can work in the fields or on the farm?
And so, I mean, then you'd had hay hands to feed, or in their week or so of thrashing, you'd have hands to feed. Hmm. And so, you know, that was what the girl helper, you know, did. And then, during the, fall, winter, or whatever, after I learned, about 10, when I learned to saddle the horse and then was considered big enough to go get the milk cows, which are about 3, and then, eventually, when I was in the sixth grade, they did have a piece of property that you could ride through up the little Pondre River, and that Grandpa owned, and so, and also later on they had pay the wildlife refuge, you know, mm-hmm. to feed cattle. But when I was 6, I rode up to the place Grandpa owned up the little Pondere, and what had happened, they had brought some cattle home, but a little calf got left behind. And so Dad and I went back, and he actually found the calf was still living. So his horse, it would work with his horse. He slung the calf back of the saddle, you know, and rode home, and I came up behind. And so he thought I was old enough that I could feed the calf.
Aww.
And then later on he added, so Mary, my sister and I traded calves, milk cows as they came along, and we teach them to drink. Now, this was no milk bottle or anything. I mean, this was holding the nose down into the bucket. And this was kind of messy until the little calf got the idea that this is how he got his milk.
Wow. Interesting.
But, and so Dad decided that when fall came, there was usually some new calves, and he'd pick out a couple he didn't think would do too well during the winter, so we'd end up, you know, we'd each have a calf, and the milk cow's calf, and so then when that calf got big enough to be sold, then we'd get half
Of the meat or the money?
Of the money.
Oh.
Yeah, when he sold the steers.
Cool. Yes, because.
And so that was. He had this worked out so that we got paid a quarter for cutting the lawn. Now, this is kind of hard because, I mean, this was hillside. I mean, there was some flat, one side had a flat piece and a hillside, and the other side had hillside. So we had to take turns.
Because you get tired of it.
And but bringing in the wood and collecting the eggs and other things, well, we didn't get paid for. Mm-hmm. But eventually, when I was in junior high, and this was after Grandpa had died, that we had a new little thing for sharpening sickles, and so we got a nickel, and then a sickle bar for a mowing machine. There were 20 sections, and he had a big stump, and you would knock out the section that was, you know, where a rock had cut out the piece, and you had mm-hmm. to put in a new section. And I was looking forward to more sections being gone, but he didn't. he was, of course, looking for far, far fewer. So, I mean, that was, but then as we grew older, like junior high, high school, we'd take salt to up the hill to the cattle and
For salt licks
and stuff. And then the other part was when there were crews working, like thrashing, that would be about a week or so, then we'd take water to the field. And this is one thing I never understood. Mother would go to town and get a wine jug, two wine jugs. And in town there was a tavern across the street from each other. And, of course, we were instructed not to ever look in the tavern. But she would come home with a couple of wine jugs, and as I got older, I wondered, did she go in? Did my dad go in? But I think that she went into the taverns and got the jugs, and then would come home and then wrap them in gunny sacks, in burlap, and then you would soak them. You know, because evaporation would cool the water, you know, in the jug. And but then when you're riding the saddle, whoops, I just came off.
Well, here, we can pause it. There, I'll still. There we go.
But when you're riding the saddle, of course, your knees are going to get soaking wet.
Mm-hmm.
But, so, I mean, that was some of the, kinds of things. I mean, since there were no brothers or girls, I mean, we both did. You had to dust in the house. And
you had to do it.
Hang out the washing and iron. And mm-hmm. So you had inside and outside chores.
Did you have electric?
We had electric washing machine. Mm-hmm. But you had.
And then you hung your clothes.
And you hung your clothes. Mm-hmm. But it was the sort of thing she filled up. You had to fill up the heat your water on the stove and then haul it down. I mean, this is this is a washing machine with a wringer, and then mm-hmm. you rinse the clothes.
Interesting.
Well, that was crazy. So we took turns hanging out the clothes on Monday. Wash on Monday, iron on Tuesday.
So it was every week you had the same schedule?
Yes.
That's cool. So let's go on to the high school then. So that's during the late 40s.
Yeah.
Any social activities or what do you remember about clothing, cars, anything?
Well, this is the sort of thing where, when I was in the seventh grade, we rode the puddle jumper, and I was very, very, I was unhappy because the bus driver had been Mike Kitt, and he died, and he was Indian, and he had died during the summer, and I thought this was very unfair. I wanted to ride the bus to town with him. But we had the puddle jumper, the oldest bus in the fleet, which meant that there were two seats, one on each side, the length of the bus. So well, this wasn't, you know, the seats across
like from each down side. This way.
Yeah,
instead
this was
like
down
that.
This way. So we rode the puddle jumper.
I didn't even know this existed. I'm sorry, but I didn't.
Well, that was our terminology for it. Because all the rest of the buses, they had seats.
Yeah, I've never seen a bus like that ever. That's crazy.
And so, junior high.
Do you remember Pearl Harbor?
Oh yes, this was. We had gone to church on Sunday morning, and I thought about this afterwards, because when we came out of church...
I should have asked Rod, too. I didn't think to ask Rod.
Came out of church, they were talking about the Japanese having bombed Pearl Harbor. And so then I remembered that Dad was walking around, he was in his 40s, was he going to be called up, but of course he never was, because he was a farmer, and they needed, you know,
they needed agriculture.
They needed that. And that was interesting, too, because then hay hands, you know, became very hard, because all the young people were off fighting. And so I can remember that at one point, he also had his favorites, you know, they would have a team of horses, and if you came and pitched hay or on the wheat, you set up bundles or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that brought the horses, of course, got more, and then Dad boarded the horses, you know, and fed them, you know, that week or whatever. And so it was very, very odd seeing the minister, who was always in his shirt and tie on Sunday, out there in his work clothes pitching hay.
During the week. That's interesting.
During the week.
So it was mostly locals that he hired?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. It was all
He didn't hire any, like, immigrant braceros, for example?
This was all local.
Interesting. So while we're on the subject of your father, he was farming his only occupation.
Oh,
he
yes.
just did that his whole life. Can you describe maybe a little bit about his physical personality traits about your dad?
Oh, he was 6 feet, and he was a head taller than his four brothers and sisters, and he was a reader also. I mean, he read books in the summertime. And, of course, he liked working outdoors, and so there was just a whole lot of outdoor work to do.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned there, he was also in politics because he served, two terms when Mary and I were growing up. And because I can remember the first term, that we drove across Washington, you know, for the legislature met for 60 days, you know, from January to March. And so we were little for the first term. And halfway across the street, across the state, we had a four-door car. And my sister, I guess, decided that she was tired of riding and opened the back door, which scared them all to death, and they eventually bought a car, which we rode all from then on through the war and whatever, that had front doors, but no rear doors.
Oh. Like just open in the back?
Oh, no. I mean, this was a sedan.
Oh, gotcha. So it was just a small...
I mean, and so... And then the other the story they tell about me and living in Olympia, you know, for January, February, March, that the first morning I heard all this clatter and wanted to know what it was, and ran to the window and mother said, "Oh, it's the milk bottles," and I ran to the window and I said, "But where's the milk cow?"
Oh. Wondering how it got there. That's funny. So didn't realize there was any way to actually bottle milk, right?
it worked out that, and maybe this is when we were going to Oren grade school, that his sessions, he was serving two terms, and so I was in the second and the fourth grade. And then we went to school in Olympia. And that was, I mean, from a country school where you had the sixth grades and everybody played together, all of a sudden I was in a room with, you know, a whole classroom of, mm-hmm. you know, just my age. And that was different.
Took a little while to get used to?
Well, I can remember in the second grade that Mrs. Dubois had taught us how, I mean, you had the Palmer handwriting up there on the wall and how you made the letters. But they were printing, and I thought, oh, well, I can write. And then in the fourth grade, of course, we brought our lunches, and Mrs. Dubois had a hot plate, and if you brought something, you know, a jar of soup or something, you could warm it up. And so, and then sandwiches the rest of the time. Well, you know, having a cafeteria, it was a whole new experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the other really new experience was that, you know, Dad had a page, and actually this page was they were probably seniors in high school, and it was the son of a friend of the family, and I can remember that they took us over to the high school, and I saw my first play.
Oh,
and but the page came, you know, and then walked me over to the Capitol building, so that, you know, I'd go home with that. But I remember getting picked up by the page.
How long did he? Do you remember how long he worked for your dad?
Well, one session.
Oh, just for the one session.
But he ended up on he was in construction. He ended up on, I think, at Wake Island and in construction, and was picked up by the Japanese and spent the year spent the war in the prison camp.
Wow. That's a whole story we can hear about, you know.
Yeah.
So tell us about your experience as being a rodeo queen.
Oh, well, that...
You didn't even write that on your pre-interview form.
Oh, well, it's...
Neat. For the sake of the recording, Sally is showing me a book called Colville Rodeo Souvenir Program for 1949 Centennial Convention.
Well, this was after the war, and this was, I think, the second rodeo that the American Legion put on after the war. I mean, this is really, really local.
Look at you.
And the challenge was, my dad, of course, belonged to the American Legion, and another in the American Auxiliary, and they were the ones that chose the queen. And then, okay, Colville was the county seat, and so the princesses mm-hmm. came from the other small towns.
Okay, gotcha.
And the challenge was that we had one horse that was getting a little, was old and getting a little weak in the hind legs, and the other horse, She was lame and been sold, and we had a brand new horse that wouldn't be safe. You know,
mm-hmm.
She's too young to do this. So we borrowed a neighbor's horse, and so I practiced riding him. That worked out all right, except he had a really bad habit of putting his head up and down.
Oh.
And so in the actual parade, I mean, you started at the north end of town. We lived south of town. And so we'd ridden in parades before. And since Mother grew up with horses, she knew all about how the whole protocol of parades. Then the ones we've been in before, you did not want to get too close to the horse in front because you wanted people to see the horse that you were riding. And of course, the rodeo queen was out in front. But you went from north to south around Main Street, and I got down at the end of Main Street, and we're going to turn left and go a little back on the neighboring street. Well, the horse was about ready to go home.
Oh, yeah.
He was okay. I mean, he... And so I got him around, but they also had riders to make sure that nothing was going to go wrong,
mm-hmm.
and he came running up, but by then I had him turned. And then the other part is, then you did the arena entrance.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the most exciting thing about that was that they had, I mean, you had your grandstand, you had the rodeo grounds where all the action was taking
uh-huh.
place, and then... The queen and princesses, we were up on a walk above the corrals, you know, where the horses
looking over.
Mm-hmm. Looking right down on.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the announcer who did all the jokes with the clown. This was then the clown's purpose was really with the bull riding,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that when the cowboy came off the horse. That there was distraction, so you know the cowboy
could get off
the field,
mm-hmm.
and so, but at one point, this was a Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon deal, and I don't remember which day it was, but they were so right underneath us, you know, they were saddling the horses or putting the straps on the bulls or whatever, and one of those bulls got loose. And you could feel this whole frame shaking.
Scary.
But they got it back in, and the thing didn't come down. But I mean, we could really, really feel the shaking.
Of course, you don't want to. I wouldn't be moving at that point. I wouldn't be moving anywhere at that point. That's great. What a great story. And this book is so neat. It's got such amazing. Just the pictures and even the first page. Howdy! I just love that. I think that's great. Is this you also?
No, let's see.
Tuffy's Riding Stables?
No.
Oh, okay. Oh, no,
this is somebody from a
riding Oh, just stable. Advertising that stable.
Yeah, it's
oh,
an
gotcha.
Advertisement.
That's and a neat book. What a great thing that you saved, you know?
And then there was another picture in the back.
Spokane Lithographing
cartoons.
Company.
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, look at that!
But at any rate, that...
There's the rodeo clowns, too.
Yeah,
that's neat.
Yes.
Cool. Okay, so... Do you want to tell me about the trip east that your father took after the war was over?
Yes.
Was that kind of in celebration of the war being over?
This was a fact. Dad hadn't been able to go anyplace. You know, and he always liked to look around at the country.
Mm-hmm.
And in grade school, in the fifth grade, we had geography, which meant that we studied the Rocky Mountains, the Great Plains, the Corn and the Hog Belt,
mm-hmm.
the South, and
like the Southwest.
The Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, we had an uncle and his family living in Chicago, and my aunt, who was a music teacher in Saginaw, Michigan, and then we had relatives in Ohio, you know, grandpa's relatives, and so this was like my geography class. I mean, you went across the mountains,
mm-hmm.
going to the Corn on the Hog Belt, and then we went over.
Did you drive in your car?
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Oh, yes, and Then we went, actually the family history was he came from Scotland to North Ireland to South Carolina and then up to Ohio. And so he wanted to see the part, you know, coming over the Smoky Mountains. And so we drove over the Smoky Mountains, saw the, well, my metal, I have metal pictures of this. You didn't take pictures, you know, like you do now. Yeah. And I've got this metal picture of this little house up on the house of the hillside. The farming patch wasn't any bigger than, you know, our garden. And there were quilts hanging. This was like October. The quilts were hanging on the fence. And so then you got down to Georgia, and you were hearing the southern accent. Got down to
feeling the humidity by then, I'm sure.
Well, this was the only time Dad could do this was like October, November.
Oh, so it was closer to the winter. That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so then at St. Augustine, there was a teeny tiny original Catholic church. And then we were going to go down to the Keys because Dad wanted to see that, but he decided we're running out of time. And so then we went around the Gulf, and this was just after a hurricane. And wow. Then it was fascinating because the concrete wall had been, you know, had been damaged. And like in one place, there was a house where it just like a knife had been cut through it, and you could look in at the bedrooms. And,
just cut in half, pretty much?
Just cut in half. And then you saw the African Americans going to town in their wagons. Well, mule. They had mules and wagons. And, you know, in my mind, well, that was like Dad going down the railroad track when he took the oats to be ground for the, these
team the
horses, mm-hmm. you know, because we didn't have a truck at that point mm-hmm. to get the wheat ground in town and then come back. And then across, well, in the New Orleans, mm-hmm. he liked museums.
Oh, did he?
So, I mean, we saw a museum and a church. I mean, we were Protestants, but he liked the Catholic church picture windows.
Oh, the stained glass.
The stained glass. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And then across Texas, a whole new, you know,
an entirely new world.
Yeah. New Mexico, we almost ran out of gas before. Hill, down across, hill, down across.
Of course, then there's no gas stations every 10 miles, you know.
And then the Navajo Indians, you know, and the towns, and across the Grand Canyon, and then up through the Utah parks. And
did your father have anything to do with local Indians around here?
Oh, Grandpa was the flour miller.
Okay.
And when he moved in... Okay, when he came across the country.
And that's your grandfather on your father's side?
Yes.
McMillan?
Yeah.
C.R. McMillan?
C.R. McMillan. Okay. His first job was as flour miller at Arden, which was about 3 miles mm-hmm. south of us, and worked for Marcus Oppenheimer.
Oh, wow.
And he'd gotten the job when he finished his circuit across the United States, and that was when he found out there was probably opening up there, and he'd learned the flour milling trade. And so a lot of the clientele were Indians. And so he learned the jargon. And one of the stories I remember that he offered one Indian to stay overnight because I was getting really late, and Indian's response was, "Say little sleep, Saya." I mean, no sleep till a long way off.
Oh.
And he thought that he had a wife and family.
Oh,
you know,
he just wanted to get home. Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was in the, probably 6 years old, that somebody came in the house and said, "There's a couple of Indian women on horseback." You know, they wanted to know if the old gentleman still lived there. And I can remember going out, he's standing under the maple tree, and these two Indians, they'd been huckleberrying. This was August.
What were they dressed like?
Oh, they had on, well, they were riding straddle, but...
But they had on dresses.
Can't remember, but it was Indian-type clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they offered to take me a ride, and I You know, it's the sort of thing I was too shy to do it, but always wished that I had. But so he had a good relation. He had a good relationship with the Indians.
Cool. Let's see what's going on here. Maybe go on a little bit about your mother, and talk kind of about did she have an occupation or was she just housewife?
After she graduated from high school in Colorado, then she went and stayed with a cousin in Cheney that taught at the Cheney Normal School, and so she had a teaching. She got a teaching certificate, and she taught in Colville, which
while you were growing up.
Okay. And she also played girls basketball in high school.
Wow.
And Cheney. And she was captain of the this was a 2-year program. And so then when she taught in Colville, she taught 5th grade and was the basketball coach.
Ah, so she carried it on from her childhood. That's neat. What kind of mother, can you describe her?
Well, let's see, she was short. Excellent horse burlin, and she was a good cook. She was a good cook for the farm, and she belonged to Ridge Group in Colville, and so there was entertaining, you know, back and forth.
So it wasn't a very, even though you were a rural family, you weren't isolated.
We were not isolated, and that was the sort of thing. I mean, Grandpa was in the legislature. He was in the last territorial legislature for Washington, and voted for women to vote.
Oh, yay! He was progressive!
Yeah, but he'd served in, like, he also served 1915 and 17 in the state legislature.
Okay.
And then with my dad, obviously that they were out, you know, circulating the community because, mm-hmm. you know, he belonged to the Legion, and that's where he'd grown up, and so
they had a.
So, you know, this was there was a sort of distinction between town and country, but they were part of both.
So here is this. I have a specific question for you. I don't know if you saw it on your questions or not. In the online, I found a record of your parents between October 27th and November 3rd of 1937. They're listed on the passenger manifest to Honolulu, and then they only stayed like a week, and then they came back. So I was just going to ask you if you remember what that trip was all about and if you went with them.
Oh no! We stayed home with Grandpa.
Oh.
I mean this was their.
Like their vacation together.
This was their vacation together, and what I remember about that was that that on the boat going one way or the other had been a couple of ladies on the ship that had been related, I think, in some way to the English royalty.
Wow!
And then in Honolulu, they, there's a picture of them with one of the natives in Honolulu, and they brought back a fan for each one of us and a skirt.
Oh, like a hula skirt?
Well,
skirt?
No, it was it had material.
Oh, like a sarong?
No,
wraparound?
I mean, we just pulled it on.
Just a regular
elastic
skirt.
Elastic skirt.
Cute.
Hmm. And so...
So those were like your souvenir mementos from your parents?
Yeah. So for when they went.
I saw the record and I thought, ooh, that's neat. I'm going to ask her about that.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's talk a little bit about Whitman College. What did you take there?
Oh, okay. Well, the other thing about Whitman is, I guess I mentioned that Grandpa sent his two daughters.
Uh-huh.
And so...
So you kind of just followed in their footsteps.
Followed in their footsteps. I was supposed to major in something by which I could earn a living if I needed to.
As long as you can earn a living, right?
I mean, this is... And so, like he said, I mean, it was fascinating from the standpoint we had from Spokane, Seattle, Portland, California students. Mm-hmm. And so, and then Whitman gave a scholar, $100 scholarship on your tuition for your first semester if you were a valedictorian.
Oh, cool.
And so, so you had an interesting mix of both, both, you know, small town and big town. And,
mm-hmm.
and this was also at the tail end of the World War II, so that there were still a few veterans left.
Mm-hmm. That were still
and coming. A lot of it is that, oh, well, and then the system was that you had the, you had your sciences, you had the social sciences,
mm-hmm.
art, music, mm-hmm. and PE, well, science and math. You were supposed to take a class in each one of those. You majored in one, but you had to have at least one class in each one of those divisions.
To try it out. That's what they make you do at PSU, too.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. so I thought, you know, that was very interesting experience. And so ended up as a education psychology major. But took a lot of history because I really did like history, but the two professors were really really excellent, and I scared off a little bit.
Is that, do you feel like that, and then of course your father liking museums, for example, did that kind of build your wanting to get involved with Washington County, for example? And other museum industries.
Well, actually, Mrs. Du Bois,
your teacher,
teacher at grade school, she had us ask, had us come up with questions about what we wanted to know about earlier times then.
Mm-hmm.
And so Grandpa talked about, you know, the Indians in the Colville Valley, and then another girl, a relative of the people that owned the mill, you know, ask questions there. And so, I mean, that triggered
that curiosity
in the history. And plus the fact, for some reason, I just really liked the idea of, I can remember, the French names. I thought those sounded fascinating, of the early explorers.
Uh-huh. All those French-Canadian trappers that came through and intermarried with the Indians.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And, it was just something, it was like learning, you know, what went on, you know, in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Dad's trip, you know, and following some of the history of that, well, that trip was my fifth grade geography class.
Mm-hmm. It basically just taught you everything you needed to know about the countryside,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, all the differences, you know, around the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I took that same trip, but that was only 3 years ago. So, right there. So let's go on to, I wanted to find out about your experiences at Oregon Historical Society.
Oregon Historical Society. Mm-hmm. Well, first I was a docent after, the boys were in school, and so really liked that because you learned.
And that's just giving tours, right,
giving tours, since I'm an education mm-hmm. major, that giving tours to grade levels.
To the different grades.
Yeah, the different grade levels, and one of the things that I think children are missing now, just tremendously.
Which is great because that's my next question about how public education has changed over the years. So go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. But this was such that we had a table set up and the curators. We had things that Indians had made and things that pioneers had made. And then, you know, we had the exhibits we could take them to. And we had an excellent Indian exhibit at that time because they had done a dig down on the coast. And they had a shelter, you know, after that. And
uh-huh.
they had some Indians volunteer to have plaster Paris so you could get their physical shape.
Interesting.
And so they made these.
When was this?
This, let's see now. This was the boys. Okay, this must.
Like 70s.
Yeah, around 1970.
Yeah, 70s.
Around that area when the boys were young.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
just so I can get a time frame of what we're talking about.
Yeah, 70s. And so, and then they had, so they had a corner of a coast house, and they had these figures there. Then they had a canoe from on the Columbia, and then they had a
Is that the same one they still have?
I don't know.
Oh.
And then they had a, well, not this exhibit. I mean,
okay, gotcha. I was going to say, because they have that Oregon, My Oregon exhibit, which is like permanent with the canoe, you know.
Yeah. And then they had a sweat house that you find you find out in particularly in Eastern Washington, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And so I can remember this one little sixth grader, and he fortunately his mother loved plants and had this book on plants that I had glanced through, so it included some of the Indian uses for plants. And so there was the sweat house, described what that was. This little first grader wearing glasses looked at me and said, "What did the Indians use for toilet paper?" Fortunately,
It's a normal question, right?
I mean, fortunately, in that book, there was something that said they'd lose big leaves.
Oh, yeah.
She saved me.
That's great.
And I thought...
That's a six-year-old kid for you, you know.
And I thought, this little kid came from Beaverton School District, and I thought, I hope I come across somebody and I ask him about this little kid. I was sure that he would have made it. And sure enough, I finally met a That's teacher hard. from that school. And I said, "You know, there was this little boy." "Oh," she said, "that was." I don't remember the name.
But she remembered him. That's funny.
But the other part was that I can remember, you know, with the Indians thing, you know, some of it was rawhide and some of it was basket, mm-hmm. and, you know, various things that they made. And once in a while, a little kid would say, "Well, you know, I've got a relative that's an Indian, you know, a grandparent or an aunt or uncle." Mm-hmm. And this one little boy looked at me and he said, "You know, I'm an Indian." And then when we went upstairs to see the exhibits, he held my hand.
Oh.
I mean, you know, Then they had some pioneer things, you know, with mm-hmm. lamps and what have sure. you. And one little girl said, "Well, you know, my grandmother has a lamp like that."
Wow.
And so, you know, this was an opportunity, you know, to see two cultures and see, you know, what things were like, you know, a different time period. Mm-hmm. And my other favorite story was with junior high kids. Now, I mean, this age group is really more interested, boys and girls, reverse.
Yeah. In each other, yeah.
We had an excellent exhibit on the Oregon Trail. And so we got into the exhibit, and these boys are saying something about mountain men and alcohol, and how am I going to get out of this one? Then I remembered about, I just lost it, the Aurora Colony.
Mm-hmm.
And the story there was that... When they left Missouri, I mean, the leader had promised his son that he was going to come to Oregon. Well, he was ill and he died, so he put him in an iron casket and poured alcohol over him. Well, the news got out, and going across the plains, I mean, to the Indians, this was huge, huge medicine. And so on the far hills, they would watch the wagon train go by. Mm. You know, they didn't have no problems. And so they settled at, first they went to Pacific County, where his grandparents grew up, and one contingent stayed in Pacific County, then the rest of them came to Aurora. Mm. And I thought, we had one docent, there was a retired teacher who had, she had taught kindergarten, she'd taught speech correction, she had taught English as a second language, And at some point along the way, she said, well, now, you, these kids, you know, take them seriously. Take them seriously. And I could remember partway through this tour, this lineup of boys at the back of the group, and they were listening. And I thought, I did just what Dorothy said. I took them seriously. Mm-hmm. I hooked them.
Mm-hmm. Only takes, you know, just got to find the right thing to hook them in, and then yeah. they'll learn anything. They'll just absorb it all, you know.
Yeah.
That's a great thing about kids. Anything else about Oregon Historical School Society that you wanted to mention?
Like what?
About OHS that you wanted to talk about maybe at all? Or?
Well, I guess mostly this was, you know, we'd meet with the docents on, I think, Monday once a month. And, you know, the curators or whatever would come and talk about the exhibits. And
then you would kind of...
Yeah,
learn
yeah,
what I you needed to learn, and then
learning. It was mm-hmm. a learning.
Interesting. Have you? Okay, so what about? Now that's where you were education director.
Yeah.
And so did you start as the docent, and then you turned out, and then eventually?
Yeah. Yes, I mean the person mm-hmm. that had started the whole program moved away.
Oh, okay. And then so you took it over.
So I did that for a couple of years.
And how many years were you actually? Working there.
I think 2 years, because then I got on the school board
in Washington
yeah.
County.
Yeah.
Okay. And so now that we're on that subject, let's talk about the school board. And so tell me about your relationship with them, your role, and the naming of the schools is what we wanted to talk about.
Well, they basically this kind of all started initially, when the boys started school, that was just, they consolidated all these small districts, 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were still, you know, working.
So you're talking about, like, Tualatin District, for example, or all those little, and then it all became one big county.
Right, all those little districts in Washington County. There were, I think, over 101 and two-room schools. Mm-hmm. And so then they consolidated them with the high schools that they were going
gotcha.
To. And, of course, there were people that were not totally enamored of the idea.
Mm-hmm. They preferred the smaller rural
right. well, they
settings?
Liked, they liked the way they... Well, and then the counties had county superintendents. And at that, and then for a long time, the county superintendents were responsible for, had things to do with, you know, making sure that teachers were qualified, and they sort of were the overseers of the all these
like small, supplies,
small districts, and you know they would do the like in the spring, you know, bring teachers together for you know catch ups and things like that. So then, but then they decided it was time they really needed to do something, and population is growing. So the legislature said that 1960 you had to call them, was the goal when the schools needed to be consolidated. And then there were votes.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were all consolidated except for the seven districts in the Hillsborough District in 1960. And so also at that particular time, the school districts ran their own levy elections. And so the boys were going to grade school at Bonnie Slope, and so they decided to, on the elections that each school was going to run the election. And then they decided that I was going to be the one that would put this, have an election board there. Fortunately, I had taken political parties and pressure groups at Whitman. And this professor...
Was that a certain course, political parties and pressure groups?
Interesting. And the smartest class I ever took. Excellent professor, but he had sent us to a precinct to observe how this was done, and I thought, boy, you know, there's a lot to this.
Yeah.
And so they told me that there was one lady whose son had been at Bonnie Slope, and that she had worked on the election board. So I called her up.
Oh, no.
And she came and walked us through this. And then I ended up on the election board. But then, and at that particular time, because of the consolidation, they'd set up a system where you would have, they'd have representatives elected at each school that would, there were three at each school, and they would have, I don't know if you'd call it really overseeing, but you would meet and talk about all the things that were going on. And you did have something about if somebody wanted to use the school, then was this a good idea or not a good idea?
Hmm. Interesting.
And so,
for a certain, you mean like a public meeting or like an event or something?
Use, okay. Mean, yeah. Who would use the school?
Gotcha. Interesting.
And so I was on the local school committee at Cedar Park. And and so from that, there became a vacancy on the school. Well, no, that wasn't quite yet. So then also in the 1970s when the Special Ed Act.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I mean, it was installed. And so the education director at our church was on the school board and wanted to know if I wanted to be on the committee for the social education, the special education committee. And so I thought about it and said, okay, yes, I'll do that. And so I was on that committee, and so we went around and visited all the programs in
for
Portland.
Special education?
Yeah. And
were there many programs in Portland at that time?
Well, you're looking at blind, deaf,
yeah,
physical.
Like autistic,
yeah,
anything.
Yeah, you were looking at a variety of programs.
So were they all consolidated into like one, for example, one school would take care of all these different kinds of conditions, or it was different schools for each kind of condition?
No, like you'd be responsible for the special ed in that district.
Okay, so in that whole, okay, gotcha.
And then the other part was that you had, as a result of no longer having people elected to a board, you know, a county board, education board, then you had people. Okay, you had the ESDs all provided some special education programs for the schools in the county. You had a county education service district.
Okay.
And so I was chosen to sit on the budget committee, you know, for the ESG.
Sure.
But at any rate, what I did was to sign up to fill out a vacancy. I thought, well, you know, I mean, I was on that those two committees, and so I thought, oh well, I mean, just to sign up to fill a vacancy on the board. I mean, Nancy Riles had been elected to the legislature, and so she couldn't fill out the last 6 months on the term.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, I'll do that, and so then it came up time for the election, and the first thing I went to fill out a form to the board was going to select the person that was going to fill in those last six things.
And mm-hmm.
I thought, well, that, I mean, that's easy.
Yeah. I can do that.
So I filled out the form, which includes your education and all that sort of thing, and took it over to the superintendent's office, and the secretary looked at that, and she said, did you come from Colville? nobody comes from Colville. That's funny. Well, I said, how did you know about it?
How'd you know that nobody comes from there? You know?
That's well, it turned out that her father worked for the Border Patrol. And they lived at Northport, near the border, and they did a lot of shopping at Colville.
So she knew about the area.
And so she knew about the area. And so I was selected to fill in the vacancy. And then after that, I ran. But
how was that?
Should I tell them about Jason?
Tell us.
We ran in. Okay, so then, let's see. I got filled in the last six terms, and so then I was elected to fill, you know, so then I was elected to serve on the board, and I was still doing some work down at the Historical Society, and Jason, they had this person sign up to run, Jason, and he came and visited every candidate, every school board member. I was not thrilled with this. This was a person that was not very tall, square build, and so he interviewed all of the current board members. He also went around to the building, got out that he was going around to all of the buildings and interviewing the principals, and no matter what they were doing, that they had, whether it was dealing with a child, a parent, or whatever, they had to stop and tour this person through the building. And macho build.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets elected. And at the first school board meeting in July, he's a no-show. And he had missed nothing. He'd been to all the board meetings, missed nothing.
All that time interviewing every single principal, you know.
And so the next morning in the paper, he's been picked up by the police.
Oh,
he's
no.
got a pistol strapped to his leg. He's got a knife in his belt. He had three weapons. I don't remember all three of them, but at least include a knife in his belt buckle. And so it turned out he was charged with blowing up a tavern and a house.
Wow.
In Multnomah County.
Crazy.
And so of course he would not resign.
That was my next question, is did they kick him off or did they, you know?
And so it was the sort of, well, you couldn't kick him off.
Yeah, I guess you can't, huh? Yeah.
And so until December, when we finally got a resignation because he'd been convicted and spent 5 years in a federal pen in the Midwest. And legislature met in January, and what came out of that legislature, if you missed four meetings, then you could be asked to resign.
Oh, interesting.
And so
they were able to do that?
But anyway, I ended up being elected for two terms on the Beaverton District. And that gets into the school names because Dr. Applegarth was a history major. And since this area, right after World War II, had been one of those areas where they did all the building and
the shipbuilding. Or are you talking about, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, just and people were moving here.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And the other thing that was happening was that the people in eastern part of the county, Raleigh Hills, and that those areas, they were empty nesters, and you were getting a whole lot of students out on the other side of the west, lower. And so they needed to do a lot of school building, but at any rate. Where were we going with this?
Oh yeah, with the
school name.
The naming of the schools.
Oh, the school names.
Yeah.
Oh, but at any rate, because after the war they started a lot of house building out here, and the builders were coming up with the names for the school. And Dr. Applegarth was a history major. And so...
of course, he's going to say, no, we need better names.
We need better names. And so he had done some original work to come up with some names that were, historical or related to Jerry. Sure.
Like Aloha High School, because it's in Aloha. Yeah.
Well, actually, Aloha was an old one.
Oh, really?
Aloha, the person that sent in to name the post office had sent in the name for the place that he came from in Wisconsin, and it came back misspelled.
Oh.
Aloha. But you see, it absolutely fit.
Really? I totally thought that the history of that name had to do with the Hawaiians that worked with the Hudson Bay Company and...
But
in
it
this
was
whole
a
area.
Misspelling from
interesting.
This is an Oregon Geographic Names.
I'll have to look that up. I haven't looked in that book in a long time.
But anyway, that's where that came from. But cool. Dr. Applegarth was also wanted to get it started to look at local related.
And names. So he was the way you're talking about it, seems like he was sort of the head of the decision-making process at that point in time.
Oh, yes.
So was he, like, the head of the board?
Oh, no. Oh, okay. That's a good question. Because, the school board is responsible for providing direction to the district, and the superintendent is responsible for,
Implementing. Yeah, okay.
But... the school board also has to carry out whatever comes out of the legislature.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, you have the financial area, the instruction area, the whole
political area. Everything.
Everything. Yeah. Yes, and you end up with this notebook that you cite federal laws, state laws, judicial decisions. And so that's one of the purposes of the school board, the State School Board Association, is the one that, does the lobbying and keeps you all alerted as to, they've passed these bills, and you're going to have to do...
And this is what we need to change.
This is what we need to change, and the school board can feedback to the State School Board Association. You pay dues based upon... student population, and the school boards can say, we need to have this done. You're basically the lobbying part for the school system.
Interesting. That's a large project to take care of.
I think that class I took at Whitman, political parties, the pressure groups.
Oh, that must have helped you so much.
I mean, that was a tremendous.
It's a really neat thing that both of you have had a chance to be such an integral part of the creation of this county, but also the entire area's history. I think that's a really neat thing.
Well, we're running out of time, but you might ask her how her grandfather got into the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, there we go. That's a good one. Well, yeah.
He ended up in the Supreme Court because...
And which grandfather was this?
Colorado. Buchanan.
This was Buchanan. Eugene Buchanan.
Eugene Buchanan.
Who was a Supreme Court.
This was an area that was not suited for farming. But at any rate, the settlers were coming in and farming anyway. And so the cattlemen were trying to save their water holes. And so this was a situation where he had his cowboys, sign up. But he was basically signing up for the water hole, the water holes that he was using, and but one of the cowboys that signed up got killed at some fight, you know, over the winter or whatever. But the hut was my grandfather's. And so the parents of the boy insisted that because the cowboy had signed up, you know, to settle on the place, that now it was theirs. And my grandfather said no, that building was his, and went to pull it away. But any rate, this was a settler rancher situation, and he ended up getting well. And then the cowboy that signed up ended up getting killed. And so my grandfather came in to pull the shack away that belonged to him, and the parents are tumbling around inside. And so I'm not sure about the process, but it ends up in federal court.
Wow.
And he wins the case, but he, you know, becomes bankrupt.
Oh, poor guy. Victory, but sad defeat at the same time, you know. That's a neat story. Yeah, and that's another one that you didn't even have. See, that's we needed Rod here today. Okay, so before we finish up, I'm just thinking about a couple of the last things that you mentioned, the flooding of Kettle Falls.
Oh, okay.
The Indian Fish.
They built Grand Coulee Dam. The Kettle Falls was a major fishing spot mm-hmm. for the Indians. I mean, they mm-hmm. came from western Montana, the Kootenays, whatever, mm-hmm. for the fishing. And
just like Salilo would have been.
It was just like Salilo. Yeah. And so this happened when I was in grade school, and I can remember that they were going to flood the flats where Fort Colville had been, and my dad, you know, drove us across the flats, you know, before it was flooded.
Oh, because he wanted you to kind of see it and enjoy the territory before it was gone. Oh.
Yeah, and so, and the other part was that there was a town of Kettle Falls down of where the base of the falls happened to be, and they moved, and I can remember following the river, Columbia River, was a lot lower than the Colville Valley. I mean, the river ran through and then it came down,
mm-hmm.
came down to the river. And I can remember following a house being on a flatbed, being towed up, you know, from Kettle Falls up to Myers Falls. Myers Falls was changed to Kettle Falls,
mm-hmm.
and the Myers Falls people were not happy.
Of course not. Yeah.
And so they moved all the houses.
Wow.
And
on barges along the river?
Well, no.
On trucks?
On land.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
On land.
For a second, I was thinking you were talking about on the road. I was like, wow.
And so, no. I mean, there was, I mean, the Indians didn't like it. The settlers didn't like it. And but it was a done deal.
Government comes in and you got no choice.
And so that there's no falls left. But it was one of the major fishing spots on the Columbia.
That's interesting. So sad to hear about those things happening. Let's see, I think that should about do it. You know, one thing I didn't ask Rod was about the Mount St. Helens eruption. And then we can end on that.
Oh, okay.
Just what you remember about it.
Oh, okay. Well, we're coming up from Eugene, and I can see this thing, and everybody was talking.
Like smoke, you mean?
Oh, the ash.
Oh.
The ash. And so,
which way was it going? It came up, and then didn't it go northeast?
It went east.
Yeah.
It went east. And actually, I mean, a lot of people out there in the Columbia Basin, they got caught.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had cousins that were going across the basin, and,
really?
You know, the ash gets into the motor.
Oh, yeah, and clogs everything up. Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing how it stuck.
Oh, really?
I mean, you could wash down your driveway, and it wouldn't be gone. And David, our younger son, was in the Sunset High School band.
Oh,
yeah. And they had
Was Portland covered in ash? Or because it went east, did Portland get saved?
Yeah, it went east, but there was still ash that fell.
Residually.
It still fell in Portland.
Okay.
I mean, it was just like little ash, you know, coming down.
That's
and it would stick to the shrubs. Everything. And, but anyway, because, I mean, there was the first eruption, but there were subsequent eruptions.
Mm-hmm. Afterwards. Mm-hmm.
And so the Sunset Band was due to, for a contest at Multnomah Stadium. And so there was some discussion as to, you know, whether, you know, breathing the ash was
a concern.
Discussion. But, and the other part was that they went out and practiced, and it was in the rain. He came back, and I put those jeans in the washer all by themselves, and I had the good sense. Fortunately, as a dasher, pulled the thing up, looked inside, and the inside was coated.
Oh, so you had to clean it out before you could do more laundry? Oh, no.
And so,
hassle.
But they did the band contest in Multnomah Stadium. Did it rain during that, I think? Mm-hmm. At any rate, that helped settle the ash. Do we do the parade or not? They did the parade. And
did you all help with any of the cleanup after or anything like that?
Well, I mean, basically it was
just
washing.
Clean up your own place.
It was, you know, just washing down your own place.
Interesting.
And seeing how long it took. Well, and
was there any fear?
I don't think so. You know, Paul Kane came out in the 1840s, the last, and had erupted, and it was interesting because he painted Indians and took a little leverage on the, he did one painting of St. Helens, and it showed lava coming down, but there was never any lava. Yeah. So you can't always depend upon you.
Yeah.
You say, oh,
a little exaggeration.
We've got these wonderful pictures of what it was like when this person came through in the 1840s. But the little fudging of...
they take their artistic license and kind of run with it sometimes. Yeah. Cool. That's a neat story. I was only a year old when that happened, so I don't remember it, you know. My mom said I was there, but, you know.
Where were you?
So, we lived in Salem at the time when I was just only a year old, you know, so, yeah. So, but I don't remember, you know. All right, I think that's about it. Do you have anything else you want to add? Any stories that we've kind of forgot? Any impressions?
Oh, let's see.
I was thinking... I think we pretty much covered most of what was on
my
questions.
No.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and say thank you so much, and we'll turn it off. All right. See, now you ended up going longer than him.
Pardon?
You ended up going longer than Rod. So you said you weren't sure you had any as much to add, but you did, so that's great.
I thought he would be far longer.
I know.